Welcome back to part three of our episode on Facing Disaster. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Jana Henning, professor of psychology and an expert on trauma and grief counseling. And again, if you would take a moment to hit subscribe before we get started, that would be fantastic. It will assure that you don't miss a moment of any of our topics. Now, Jana, thank you so much for joining me and joining the audience.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Now, I understand that trauma and grief are related, but distinct experiences. Can you please define those for me?
So if we're thinking about a reaction that extends a little bit beyond the immediate, you know, we would expect anybody to have responses immediately following a disaster of some kind or any sort of traumatic event. And then for most people, those are going to resolve in a fairly short period of time. But for some people, their symptoms may extend past a month, 6 months, even beyond. And people may experience what we would call post-traumatic stress kinds of reactions and or grief and loss kinds of reactions. And even though they're likely to occur or sort of be intertwined with somebody who has been through a traumatic incident and also had losses, interestingly enough, the psychology or counseling field has really not looked at them together, so they've often looked at them separately. So there are people who have expertise in post-traumatic stress responses. There are people who have expertise in grief and loss responses. Hardly anybody has expertise in both, and there are very few models to how to treat them both together. So I can talk a little bit about each one if that would be helpful for us.
Because, again, to me, the layperson, it seems like it would be frequent that you would have them together.
Right.
I'm just saying.
Right.
I don't have schooling in this, but
right.
That makes sense. So, if you would give us a little bit more information,
yeah,
please.
It seems obvious to me, too, and I'm a person who has training in both, and I'm really kind of trying to push research forward and teach our students at Adler University how to deal with both as well. So post-traumatic responses, you know, and again, this is if they're extending beyond about 4 weeks, we expect anybody to have some sort of responses after a traumatic event, would include things like what we would call re-experiencing. So having intrusive memories that come back at you when you don't want to be thinking about what happened, it pops back in your mind and causes distress. Or things like nightmares or even flashbacks where you feel like you're reliving it. It's happening to you all over again. It might also include what we call avoidance. So you want to stay away from things that remind you of what happened to you. There might be triggers in the environment. Sometimes even things that you are not consciously associating as a trigger. So a color or a smell or a sound or something that was present at the time of the traumatic event. And if you experience it again now, it sort of flips your mind back into it. And you may have a flashback or an intrusive memory. So people will kind of constrict their lives. They don't want to go out. They don't want to do things. They want to stay home so that they're not being exposed to these triggers. And so their lives become, you know, very limited and very constricted in some ways. Also, people will experience changes in how they think. So how does the world work? What kinds of things are going to happen in the world? Who's responsible? Who's to blame? Even changes in spirituality and changes in mood. So depressed or sad mood. Mood or angry or irritable reactions, and then also people who are just kind of amped up fight or flight reactions as well. So you're always feeling hypervigilant, you're always monitoring for threats. So if those symptoms persist over time, then the person may have what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder. So not everybody's going to develop those kinds of reactions. A pretty small percentage will, because a lot of people have sort of a natural ability to cope with that, to roll with it, to overcome it. And the percentage of people who will develop post-traumatic stress varies depending on the trauma. So with an acute disaster like a hurricane or a bombing or a mass shooting, you would typically see a lower percentage compared with somebody who's had a sexual assault or a violent assault or attempted homicide. And part of that has to do with someone else chose to do that to you. So it's actually more traumatizing for somebody if there's human wrongdoing involved.
Versus what would be considered an act of God.
A tornado, a hurricane, you know, where it's very traumatizing. But it's not necessarily caused by somebody's deliberate choice to harm you. A bombing is different. A terrorist attack is different. A shooting is different.
Because then you're trying to get behind the mindset of how
right,
that occurred.
Like, and maybe change your idea about how the world works and what people are like. Are they basically good? Is everybody out to harm you? You may have thought before, well, you know, nobody's going to harm me. And then something like this happens to you, and now you think everybody's going to harm me. So okay. It really changes the worldview.
But that to me, and again, you're the expert on this, but that seems to be a loss in itself right there. So you do have post-traumatic stress disorder, and then you're going through a potential loss of what you believe.
Yeah. So that's one of the places where the two things intertwine.
Okay.
And so
like the Venn diagram.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit and talking about grief reactions, it used to be thought that, you know, we went through these Kubler-Ross stages of dying, and that's all been completely debunked about 30 years ago. There's no research support. There's no evidence to support that at all. Instead, what we know now is people have very unique, individual, personalized responses that may include things like sadness or grief, but it also might include anger or even elation. You know, now I understand the true meaning of life, and there's this sense of, you know, almost like ecstatic joy that could also then be followed by anger or grief. You know, that the emotions sort of are intertwined, or they follow each other. So first you're feeling one emotion, and then you're feeling a very different emotion shortly thereafter. Also, changes in relationships. You know, you may find that you're pulling back from people, or you may find that you're clinging to people and wanting to be around people more. People may experience things like sleep changes, appetite changes, so more physical changes, maybe more vulnerability to viruses, to colds, to getting sick, things like that. And then really, as you noted a few minutes ago, a loss of meaning or, you know, a sense of purpose in life. So it's a different set of symptoms, but there is some overlap between the two.
So when people are seeking help for these separately, can they find someone who can help them if they're experiencing both?
So that is a great question. Hardly anybody is trained in both. Very, very, very few people are trained in both. And relatively few people are trained in either, sadly enough. So even though you would think traumatic life events, grief and loss, this is going to be like the club of most of us, in many counseling and psychology programs, there may be only one course at the most. Some programs have none. So there are relatively few providers who are well trained to deal with traumatic stress or grief and loss, let alone both. So you really want to kind of look for somebody who has credentials so that they kind of they know what they're doing and they're following what research tells us is the best way to go. So the treatment approaches are a little different, which is why I think that providers need to sort of figure out, well, what's the most important thing? What's the priority here? So treatment approaches for traumatic stress often include some sort of restructuring of the thinking. So if you have a belief that the world is full of terrible, dangerous people and bad things are going to happen to you, there has to be some looking at that as to whether that's actually the most accurate or adaptive way of looking at things. It's sort of understandable that your thinking was changed in the aftermath of trauma, but is it really helping you as you're going forward and trying to live, you know, the average day-to-day life? Also, effective trauma treatments often include something that they call exposure. So the idea of bringing a person back either through a written narrative or through some sort of, you know, walking through the going back to the place where the trauma occurred, and then you're having a new learning experience where, let's say you were assaulted in an elevator, you've been avoiding elevators, to go to an elevator and say, okay, I'm in an elevator, nothing bad is happening to me, I'm breathing, I'm walking myself through it, and I'm okay, I'm making it, and then new learning occurs that every time I step on an elevator, something bad isn't going to happen to me.
Even though all of the other occurrences in an elevator had been fine until the one.
Right, because the one, the traumatic event,
wiped the others.
So almost dramatically flipped the thinking and the body's experience. So now you get in the elevator and you're being cued, oh my God, you know, this space, the paneling, the sound of the elevator, and it's all taken me back.
So then you're having a physical reaction.
In many people, yes. As well as an emotional and a cognitive one.
Okay.
So one of the cures for that is to go back to the elevator and say, okay, I'm walking myself through this, I'm breathing, I'm feeling some distress, but it's going to go down by itself over time. I can do this, I can handle this. And then the new learning occurs that, okay, now I've been in an elevator and it's safe. So for some things like a sexual assault or a, you know, natural disaster, you can't put the person back into that.
Right.
So how they often handle it instead is to do a written narrative. So a very detailed written description of what it was like for the person that brings in not only all the details, but what you were feeling, what you were thinking, what your body experiences were, because that's a way to relive it, you know, when we can't actually put somebody back in a traumatizing scenario.
and relive it with the detailing without having to actually go through the stress of that.
And then you reread the narrative every day for a period of time, add new things as the brain sort of shifts its understanding of what's happened, new thoughts come
in. The digesting
in.
Digesting
is a great word. And then to expand that narrative and then reread it and expand it and reread it. And for many people, this really drastically reduces the symptoms. So most effective treatments for trauma include some aspect of re-experiencing, you know, desensitizing, and some aspect of working through the thinking to bring it into something that's a little bit more adaptive and flexible rather than everything is bad and scary and more bad things are going to happen to me. Now, for some people, they have some trouble managing their emotions, regulating their emotions, or handling distress, and they may benefit from first being taught how to calm themselves down, how to manage their emotions when they start to get really upset or fearful, how to sort of bring themselves back to baseline. So some trauma treatment models would have a provider first teach the client how to calm themselves down, how to manage distress, how to ground oneself if you're feeling a little out of body before trying to go into the restructuring or the exposure.
So those are almost or could be considered anxiety type responses?
So yeah, I mean, it used to, actually PTSD used to be grouped with anxiety disorders, and now in the most recent diagnostic statistical manual, it's shifted into a trauma response. But there's a lot of similarities there, sort of feelings of panic, fight or flight reactions in most people.
The way you were describing it in your body language, made me associate with it, because it seemed like the heart rate was up and your body kind of became tense when you were describing
it. For most people, there's a small group of people who will, what we call dissociate, meaning they're sort of blocking a lot of things out and maybe are experiencing almost a flatness, not experiencing anything in the body, almost a numbness. And sort of robotically able to repeat what had happened in the trauma without experiencing any of the emotions or the body sensations.
Oh, fascinating.
But then those may come later on, like at night when you're not doing anything, all of a sudden you may be reliving.
I can only imagine that there are people listening who have experienced this or are continuing to experience after effects of trauma or grief or loss. How are they, who are they looking for? What are the credentials of people they're looking for to get help from?
So if I were looking for a provider for a post-traumatic stress sort of scenario or symptoms, because sometimes people have a lot of symptoms but not all of them, so maybe they wouldn't fully get that diagnosis, but they have enough symptoms that therapy will help, I would look for somebody who describes the kind of training they've specifically had in traumatic stress. You know, whether they have credentials like certifications, what sorts of workshops or full semester courses they've taken. You know, I would want to know, okay, how have you been trained? And also, how do you think about trauma? So if providers are not able to describe really clearly what they do and how they approach it, then I would be concerned. So if you ask a potential therapist, well, how do you approach trauma? And they're like, well, you know, I kind of talk to the person and wait and see. And I'd be a little bit more nervous. So if somebody has a really clear roadmap, here's what research tells us works, here's what I do, here's why it works, then that would feel reassuring to me that someone has a plan and is matching it to what research tells us works.
It is easy for me to say sitting in this chair. However, I do want people to remember that you are the customer when you are seeking a therapist or anything. And so you have every right to ask questions and interview and leave if you don't feel comfortable with your treatment. You can find someone else.
I could also share a little bit about the treatment of grief, because we didn't talk
about
that.
I would love, that was actually where I was headed next. Yeah. So please.
So what's a little bit different is it's so unique, so individual, so personal, how people respond to loss. And there are a number of different kind of losses that might go with a traumatic event. And then there are also what we call sub-losses underneath that. So for example, if a loved one was killed in a traumatic event, there are a number of sub-losses under there. So the loss of the person's company, the loss of the future you thought you were going to have with them, the loss of the role you played with that person, and many, many other aspects of that loss that are very unique for each person. So if someone says, my mother died, we may think from our own position, what would it be like if my mother died? Mm-hmm. And think that's what that person is going through, when actually they may be thinking, you know, some very different things based on how it has changed his or her life to lose that role, rather than what would it be like if I lost my mother. Mm-hmm. So we have to be really careful as providers not to project our own understandings of how this is going to impact this person. There may be anger instead of grief. Somebody may be more concerned about financial changes, losing that person, rather than sort of more tender or emotional reactions. So the key for a provider is understanding, okay, what is the loss? In the person's own words, and what is the worst part of this loss for you, or the hardest part? And, you know, if there are multiple losses, which sometimes there are. So in the case of Katrina, people lost loved ones, they lost their homes, they lost all their belongings, they lost their neighbors, they mm-hmm. lost their community. Instead of going in and saying, you know, I'm assuming that losing your loved one was the worst part of this, you'd want to come in and say, okay, what are all the losses? And which one do you want to talk about first?
Because they might have also lost their job, which was their security
exactly.
to provide for
exactly.
everyone else.
So to understand what loss they view as the most pressing right now, and then what are the aspects of it that are the most problematic or difficult for them. And so many people in the grief and loss field now believe that the best way to go about this is to sort of understand how the person understood the world before the loss, and then understand how the loss has changed their understanding of the world. So they call it the assumptive world, that we all go through life with assumptions about how things are going to go. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I'm an adult and I have a child, my assumption is my child will outlive me. If my child dies while still a child, that blows up my understanding of how the world is supposed to go. Mm-hmm. So this can be very difficult for people. Or another example would be something happens that you had no way of anticipating could ever happen, and so you don't have any sort of plan in your head or understanding of how the world is supposed to go because this just hit you out of left field. So most of us, you know, we have a sort of roadmap. If this happens, I sort of know how I'm going to go forward, or it's not too shockingly unpredictable. But if something happens you couldn't even conceive of, then you're really lost. Like, I don't know how to go forward in the world. What I thought the world was, there's no connection between that and what the world is actually turning out to be.
Right, because a loss of a parent or an elderly mm-hmm. family member, yeah. while not necessarily expected, but it still makes sense in the yeah. order of the world.
Yes, in the normal span of life, this is what we would expect.
Right.
But if that person dies under traumatic circumstances, then there may be other aspects of our understanding of the world that get shaken up. Mm-hmm. So in order to intervene, the provider needs to know, okay, well, where is the place that's causing the most pain and distress here? Mm. And then try to help connect a couple things. One is connect things that were true in the past with things that are still true. So, you know, even if I've lost a loved one, or if I've lost my home or my job, what remains? What is still here? In what ways am I still myself? And what can I sort of carry forward and focus on? Also, to try to create a new life going forward in the absence of whatever has been lost. And often that's taking small steps. So when, for example, my own stepfather died a few months ago, and so our family at Christmas had to figure out, okay, what are the new rituals? What is the new way for Christmas to be in our family now that this one beloved person is no longer with us? Mm-hmm. And often that's baby steps. You know, we in this society, we think people are going to get over grief and loss really quickly. You know, you've got a couple of days and you've got to come back to work, you know, or it's been 2 weeks. Why aren't you over that yet? Research tells us a lot of people take much longer to sort of feel okay inside, 6 months, a year even sometimes. So, you know, to understand it's different for every person, the timeline is different, and the feeling of being yourself or having some happiness in life may come back a little piece at a time. So taking baby steps, small steps, okay, now I'm going to try to do this today, now I'm going to add this smaller piece a week later, but gradually coming back into a routine that involves reconnection with people you care about who are supportive, reconnection with the values and the goals that you believe in, which may take some time. So a therapist who's working with somebody around grief and loss has to be very creative in understanding where the distress is coming from and creatively helping the person perhaps memorialize what's been lost, perhaps create a new vision for the future, perhaps a new understanding of who I am now that my loved one isn't here. Like, for example, if my partner dies, who am I without that partner? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of creativity, individual type of work. There isn't a template for how to work with grief. There's sort of a general set of strategies, but it has to be so unique and customized for the person who's experienced the loss. So if somebody has both, mm-hmm. my question as a provider would be, which is the most problematic now? If the person's having flashbacks, if they're having intrusive memories, if they're finding they cannot function, they don't want to go back to anything that reminds them of the trauma, I might focus on that first because it's really limiting their quality of life. However, some people may not experience those things, but instead they're feeling, you know, extreme sadness or almost a feeling of despair, like, I don't know what my life is like now in the context of this loss. Then I might be focusing on that instead, even if the person is having some nightmares or some sort of fight or flight reactions because the grief and loss is actually causing them the most distress right now. So then I would, with a client, collaborating with the client, which one feels the most important to you? Which one is causing you the most distress? Is it the trauma-related symptoms, or is it the reaction to the loss? And so then I might pick whichever one the person is reporting to me is most problematic to them and focus on that. Because the therapeutic approaches are a little different.
Really, really interesting stuff. Thank you for sharing that and educating me and others about that, because I really didn't know it was separate. So very interesting on how the therapies can be approached differently, and yet the research continues on mm-hmm. how to incorporate these together. This actually concludes our show. Jana was our final guest today. Please join us next week for our episode on the dangerous lives of Black children. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And one last time, I will ask you to hit subscribe on that podcast button so you don't miss a moment. Thanks so much for listening.